This year marks the 125th anniversary of Thomas Edison's invention of the phonograph. Edison's mechanical technology remained in use until the mid-1920s, when a new technology, based on electricity, changed the sound of popular music. In the second installment of his series Technopop, The Secret History of Technology and Popular Music, NPR's Rick Carr reports on the Jazz Age electrification of pop.
From the sound of my voice, you may think that there's something wrong with your radio. There isn't. During the first half century of recording, this is how singers made records. Antique phonograph collector Peter Dilge is helping us make this recording. Peter, what is it that we're doing right now?
I'm speaking into a 24-inch tin recording horn. The vibrations are going down the horn, vibrating a glass diaphragm. It's a little sapphire cutting stylus which cuts a U-shaped groove into the wax.
In other words, as we speak into the horn, our voices are amplified as they travel from the wide end to the skinny end, and the very vibrations of our voice are cutting the groove directly into the wax. Recordings made this way are called acoustical recordings because the whole process is driven by sound. It's entirely mechanical. Until the mid-1920s, it was pretty much the only way to record sound. Then in the mid-1920s, little metal electrical boxes called microphones replaced the recording horn, and wires and motors replaced the mechanical diaphragm and stylus that Edison had invented.
And suddenly, singers sounded almost like they were whispering right in listeners' ears. The shift in sound shocked fans and performers. David Baker is professor of music at Indiana University in Bloomington and director of the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra. He says for musicians, the electrical process was the sonic equivalent of someone wiping a thick layer of grease and dust off a pair of eyeglasses.
All of a sudden, they could hear what it is they were doing, and they were aware that there was something happening intuitively that made what they were doing qualitatively different than what they'd been doing before.
What musicians had been doing before, like singers, was performing at full volume so that the vibrations their instruments made would be strong enough to engrave the wax. David Baker says even so, the recorded results could be so unclear that the musicians couldn't tell if someone was out of tune or even playing in the wrong key.
Like there's one recording with Louis Armstrong where Lil Hardin Armstrong is blithely playing in the wrong mode. They're playing major and she's playing minor. And there are people who then learn to play thinking that was what was intended.
Legend has it that at that 1923 session, Louis Armstrong played so much louder than anyone else in King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band that the recording engineer had to make him stand in the hallway outside the studio so that he didn't drown out everyone else. That's because an acoustical studio had a single recording horn mounted on a wall. To balance the relative volume of various instruments, recording engineers made loud players on loud instruments stand far from the horn while quieter players crowded around it. James Lastra teaches the history of sound and film at the University of Chicago.
You can find old photographs of musicians in these absurd arrangements on high stools and, you know, with the piano at the other end of the room, just to get them to balance the sound properly. And these would be things you would never do in performance, but were perfectly appropriate to the technology.
Lastra says the limitations of the technology actually determined what kinds of instruments were used by jazz bands. Banjos recorded more clearly than guitars, tubas cut the wax better than string basses. By the mid-1920s, engineers who'd been working on radio and experimenting with film had perfected the microphone. Like the diaphragm in an acoustical recording setup, it responded to sound vibrations in the air. But instead of translating those vibrations directly into the motion of a stylus that cut the wax, it changed them into corresponding electrical vibrations, which in turn could be amplified, then used to drive a motor of sorts that moved the stylus that cut the wax. Almost overnight, record companies replaced their acoustical recording setups with electrical gear. And almost overnight, according to music journalist and historian Gary Giddens, record labels started recording different kinds of singers.
The early, very primitive recording system favored tenors, high voices, because it was so primitive that you needed something strong and hard and high to really penetrate.
When the wintry winds are blowing and the snow is starting in the fall, then my eyes turn westward, knowing that's the place that I love best of all.
The new sound, the electrical sound, which was introduced first on radio and then on records, favored the baritone. It favored nuance, it favored subtlety and detail.
Gary Giddens says the first and biggest beneficiary of the new technology was a young baritone from Spokane, Washington, named Harry Lillis Crosby, better known as Bing.
Muddy water around my feet, muddy water in the street, just God's own shelter. Down on the delta, muddy water in my shoes, rocking to those low-down blues. They live in ease and comfort down there, I declare.
As Gary Giddens wrote in the first volume of his Crosby biography, A Pocketful of Dreams, Bing was among the first performers to record in electrical studios. Giddens says Bing realized that the microphone was his instrument because it meant he no longer had to sing like he was projecting to the last guy in the last row of the theater.
Crosby was the first person to understand the paradox that electricity didn't make music less human, it made it more human because you could do more with it. For the first time, singers weren't singing at you, he was singing to you. You get an erotic current to popular music that did not exist before, which is why he became such a sensation on radio.
Electrification changed everything that Bing Crosby did, according to Gary Giddens. In fact, he says it made Bing into a superstar while allowing him to avoid doing what performers for all of human history had done, actually showing up in theaters or cafes or caves or around campfires and performing for anyone who'd listen.
When he was able to stop performing live, he basically did. And between the early 1930s and his swan song in 1976, except for benefits, he never appeared live. And yet, if you talk to people who were around then, they're shocked to discover this. He was everywhere, but he was only available through the technology. And he was the first artist who ever pulled that off or wanted to.
Half a century before Howard Stern made the claim, Bing Crosby was the king of all media. Thanks to electrical technology, his films topped box office charts, his recordings were million sellers, and he had one of the most popular shows on radio. Later in life, Bing helped repay his debt to technology by funding the engineers who developed the next revolution in sound recording 20 years later. And that's a story for another day. Rick Carr, NPR News.